understanding that there is only one, and that one we call God, that one we call Spirit, by many names, is all there is. The great infinite totality of everything with a simple name nonetheless is the great infinite. And because there is that only that one, I know I am one of it. I know we are all one of it, part of it, with the same possibilities, capabilities, desires. It's the same wholeness, most especially. Nothing lacking, all one thing. So today, in this beautiful space, in this joyous connection of spirit, I open my mind and I open my heart and celebrate this community, this oneness, this love that shows up as us, as me and each of the people in this room, as me and the people on the planet. We show up together as that one, choosing and moving from heart, from spirit, out into the world with infinite possibilities. I'm grateful to know this. I am grateful to feel this oneness. I am grateful to understand the power of my hands, my feet, my heart, my mind. Because I know that power isn't mine. It's God's, and I am simply the instrument, or complexly the instrument. It's not that simple. But it's pretty easy. In gratitude, I release these words. In gratitude, I send them forth, knowing that as the law listens and moves, these words create. So together we say, and so it is.
Oh, it's so good to be back here. Thank you, guys. Today's a really good and exciting talk because we're going to get to talk, or I get to talk, but we will have some dialogue around desire, which is quite powerful. So Denny is putting up this beautiful slide for us. I noticed our songs we were singing and the readings talked a lot about love today. And this is a picture from the HeartMath Institute of what our electromagnetic field is when our heart is open. That's what it looks like. And if you want to have a really powerful, deep meditation, Google the HeartMath Institute open-heartedness or electrical magnetic field and look at that picture as your focal point. So instead of focusing on a candle or on your breath, focus on the electromagnetic field of your heart. And so before we dive into this topic of desire, just close your eyes for a moment. And I'm going to ask you to put your intention on your heart to open wider than it is right now. And the more we practice intentionally opening our heart, the easier it becomes. Sometimes I place my hand on the heart. Sometimes I imagine my breath breathing through the heart. And I just intend, heart, open wider. And just take a minute to feel the love that's in this room. Thank you. And I want to give you a little practice you can do. When I'm not speaking places, I often go and hear other ministers speak, and I was going and listening to this one minister, and I had huge judgment. My head was like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I just stopped myself and said, open your heart, Bonnie, and I went like that, and it was the best service I ever attended because I was in a space of total and complete bliss. So to keep that as a practice, that if there's something where your head or your mind is just going crazy, just go heart, and let yourself be that field in that place. All right, so we're going to talk about desire. I'm going to start by reading a very pertinent, powerful story. And as I do, it's a little lengthy, so what I'm going to tell you is that there is a test at the end of this. There really is. So let's stay together on it. So this is from the book, The Power of Habit. She was the scientist's favorite participant. Lisa Allen, according to her file, was 34 years old, had started smoking and drinking when she was 16, and had struggled with obesity for most of her life. At one point in her mid-20s, collection agencies were hounding her to recover $10,000 in debts. An old resume listed her longest job as lasting less than a year. The woman in front of researchers today, however, was lean and vibrant, with the toned legs of a runner. She looked a decade younger than the photos in her chart and like she could out-exercise anyone in the room. According to the most recent report in her file, Lisa had no outstanding debts, didn't drink, and was in her 39th month at a graphic design firm. "How long since your last cigarette?" one of the physicians asked. Starting down the list of questions, Lisa answered every time she came to the laboratory outside of Bethesda, Maryland. "Almost 4 years," she said, "and I've lost 60 pounds, and I've run a marathon since." She'd also started a master's degree, had bought a home, and had an eventful stretch. The scientists in the room included neurologists, psychologists, geneticists, and a sociologist. For the past 3 years, with funding, they had poked and prodded Lisa more than 24 times, along with other former smokers, chronic overeaters, problem drinkers, obsessive shoppers, and people who had other destructive habits. All of the participants had one thing in common. They had remade their lives in a relatively short period of time. Does this interest you? Yeah. Totally interests me. The researchers wanted to understand how, so they measured subjects' vital signs, installed video cameras inside of their homes to watch their daily routines. They sequenced their DNA with the technologies that allowed them to peer into people's skulls in real time. They watched their blood flow and electrical pulses going through their brain when they were tempted with things like smoking cigarettes or eating lavish meals. They were trying to figure out at a neurological level how change takes place. "I know that you've told me this story dozens of times," the researcher says to Lisa, "but would you mind telling it again for all of us?" "Sure," she said. "It started when I was in Cairo." The vacation had been somewhat of a rash decision, she explained. A few months earlier, her husband had come home from work and announced that he was leaving her because he was in love with another woman. It took Lisa a while to process this betrayal and absorb the fact that she was actually getting a divorce. There was a period of mourning, then a period of obsessively spying on him, following his new girlfriend around town, calling her after midnight and then hanging up. Then there was the evening that Lisa showed up at the girlfriend's house, drunk, pounding on her door, and screaming that she was going to burn this condo down. "It wasn't a very good time for me," she said. "But I had always wanted to see the pyramids, and my credit cards weren't quite maxed out yet." So, on her first morning in Cairo, Lisa woke at dawn to the sound of a call to prayer at a nearby mosque. It was pitch black inside her hotel room. Half blind and jet-lagged, she reached for a cigarette. She was so disoriented that she didn't realize until she smelled burning plastic that she was trying to light a pen, not a Marlboro. She had spent the past 4 months crying, binge eating, unable to sleep, and feeling ashamed, helpless, depressed, and angry all at the same time. Lying in bed, she broke down. "It was like this wave of sadness," she said. "I felt everything I had ever wanted had crumbled. I even couldn't smoke right." Have any of you guys ever been there? "And then I started thinking about my ex-husband and how hard it's going to be to find another job when I get back home and how much that I'm going to hate it and how unhealthy I feel all of the time. And I got up and I knocked over a water jug and it shattered all over the floor, and then I started crying even harder. I felt desperate. I had to change something, at least one thing I could control. She showered, she left the hotel, and she rode through Cairo's rutted streets in a taxi and then onto dirt roads leading to the Sphinx, the pyramids of Giza, and the vast endless desert around them. Her self-pity for a brief moment gave away, and she needed a goal in her life, she thought, something she could work toward. It was a crazy idea, Lisa knew. She was out of shape, she was overweight, she had no money in the bank, she didn't know the name of the desert that she was looking at. As if this trip were possible, she decided while sitting in the taxi that she would come back to Egypt and trek the desert. None of that mattered, though. She needed something to focus on. Lisa decided that she'd give herself 1 year to prepare. And to survive such an expedition, she was certain she would have to make sacrifices. In particular, she would need to quit smoking. Then Lisa finally made her way across the desert 11 months later in an air-conditioned and motorized tour with a half a dozen other people. Mind you, the caravan carried so much water, food, tents, maps, global positioning systems, and two-way radios that throwing in a carton of cigarettes wouldn't have really made a difference. But in that taxi that day, Lisa didn't know that. And to the scientists at the laboratory, the details of her trek weren't even relevant. Because for reasons they were just beginning to understand, the one small shift in Lisa's perception that day in Cairo, the conviction that she had to give up smoking in order to complete her goal, had touched off a whole series of changes that would ultimately radiate out into every part of her life. Over the next 6 months, she would replace smoking with jogging, and in turn, how she would eat, how she worked, slept, she saved money, she scheduled her work days, planned for her future, and so on. She started running half marathons and then full marathons. She decided to go back to school to buy a house, and she got engaged. Eventually, she was recruited into this study where they began examining images of her brain, and they saw something remarkable. One set of neurological patterns, her old habits, had been overridden by new patterns. Isn't this new science stuff really cool? They could still see the neural activity of her old behaviors, but those impulses were crowded out by new urges. As Lisa's habits changed, so did her brain. It wasn't the trip to Cairo that caused the shift. It was that Lisa had focused on changing one habit, and that was smoking. They call the focus on one habit a keystone habit. Lisa had taught herself how to reprogram her mind by looking at one habit and letting the rest fall into place. I want to show your most recent scans, he said, pulling up her scans. However, in this new area, he said, where we believe behavioral inhibition and self-discipline starts, this activity is more pronounced than when you came in. So they watched over time her brain rewire itself. And everyone in the room knew that they were onto something real important. So take just 1 minute and turn to a person next to you and tell them, what about that story really got you? What about the change in Lisa inspired you? All right, when you're done, thank your partner. This is why I love the story, and these are the three things that I wanted to point out. First, transformation starts with a desire. Second, then, it's that desire that encourages new behaviors to align with it. And then third, the brain actually remakes itself. We now have the science that prove this. The brain remakes itself to align with our new emerging self, our new self that is becoming. So the first time that I had really had the thought of desire stick with me was when I was reading a Catherine Ponder book. And how many of you are familiar with Catherine Ponder? Okay, Catherine Ponder, old metaphysician, wrote a whole bunch of books on money and prosperity. And she said, that the word desire means D of the sire, father. Desire means of the father. And ever since I read that, I thought of desire as being this just most holy, fabulous, magnificent thing that we as human beings get to experience. The second thing is, how many of you are familiar with David White? Yes, right? Yes. The poet David White. David White says that desire is the calling of the soul to have itself fulfilled. Isn't that beautiful? The calling of the soul to have itself fulfilled. And then if you go to the dictionary and you look up desire, it says D means downward, D in Latin in this description, this. And then it says it's from the word sider, which means the stars. So downward from the stars, desire, decider, downward of the stars. From the stars comes a desire. And then this last year, I have been teaching an online class called Momentum and Miracles. And it's for people who feel stuck and they want to have some momentum going. They want to get unstuck and then open to miracles. So for 30 days online, through Facebook Live, I would do this program called Momentum and Miracles. And one day I went into meditation to ask God for me what my definition of desire is. And it was so beautiful because what I saw was the head and the heart merging together as though the head and the heart were lovers, as though they were married beings and birthing a baby called desire. And it was the energy of it was really beautiful. But the idea is the desire is the merging of that beautiful heart electromagnetic field we saw along with the head or the idea, like what came through for Lisa. Oh, here's this idea. And we all know, where do divine ideas come from? Hello. So it's like the head, the idea, the God thought merging with that whole big, huge, beautiful field, and it gets planted in there. And then we start moving with this propulsion. So I look back at Lisa's story and I see that the heart field is really where our feelings come from, where our emotions are, where we are moved. That's our heart. It is the non-language energetic, if you will. And so when Lisa was in the taxi, if you remember in that part of the story, she said she was so incredibly distraught that she felt like she couldn't do anything right, and she felt all of the feelings of the failure that she hadn't let herself feel. And so in that state of this huge open field, bam, this desire comes through and implants itself. Does that make sense? Okay. And so we can open our field intentionally, and that's why I'm saying it's a really great practice throughout your day to, if you're too much in your head or you're too la-la-la, is to literally stop yourself and practice opening your heart, because that becomes the fertile field. Okay? And then years ago, I was speaking at Easter at a service, and I was thinking about all the transformational stories in the Bible, because I was going to be speaking from the Bible. And what I realized was that the major stories that we got as children that included transformation, that they all had the same formula in it. They all had some kind of emotional experience with the breath, and then with the implanting of an idea or a yes, and then a moving forward into transformation or a new life. And an example of that would be when the angels came to Mary to say, Mary, hey, you're not married, you're a virgin, and guess what? We're going to give you a kid. And she was scared. And the angels, the first thing they said was, do not be afraid. Remember that? Maybe. Okay, they go, do not be afraid. And then they say to her, this is our plan. This is what we want to do. We want to impregnate you and have you bear the presence of God in human form. This is what we want. And she says, yes, I am a follower. I love the Lord. I'm happy to do it. But she had to buy in and say yes. So there was the heart, the fear, the opening, and then the yes, which was the agreement that ended up getting planted. So that's first. First is that we open the heart. The second thing then is that desires encourage behaviors aligned with it. And since it's almost the end of June, that means we're more than halfway through the year. How many of you guys set an intention for 2019? How many of you have aligned your behaviors with that intention and you're cruising with it? Oh, yeah. Okay, excellent. Excellent. That's fabulous. And this is what I say, it's never too late to set your intention for the new year, even if you're in mid-year. So know that you can say for the rest of the year that this is my intention. So I had a really, really, really horrible year last year, a real crappy year. And no matter what, I get up and I do my spiritual practices, no matter what, I stand and do as much as I can to allow my heart to stay open and the light to come through me. And this year, this last year was hard. And it hit fast and sequentially. And I won't go through any of the stories except to say at the tail end of these horrible things, at the tail end of it, I had 6 friends die in 4 weeks, including my best friend. And it was like, oh, you know, God, can I take any more? Which is the wrong question. But it's like, really, are you kidding me? Yes. So 2019 came along, and I set my intention that I was going to do my bucket list this year. And so this year, I went to Scotland to go study with Dr. Joe Dispenza. I went to go study meditation with him. And I leave in a couple months to go to Ireland to study fairies and divas in the land. And then after that, I'm going to Bali to go visit some temples. And I went back to school and became a shamanic Reiki master, which was really fun. And then I went to school to become an herbologist and to learn about the power of plants and healing. So this year for me was a resurrection year. It was a year of this is going to be my bucket list because I had to get back to my heart and back to my soul after my experience of last year. So it was one thing to say to myself, this is the year of recreation. It was another thing to align my behaviors to go along with it, right? Okay, so that was the second thing that I took away from this. And then the third thing I took away was that the brain changes. And this is where science of mind is so amazing and where Dr. Ernest Holmes was way before his time. Dr. Ernest Holmes wrote his original first textbook in 1926 and he died in 1960. He talked about in the back of the text where they have the symbol in the back there and they have the 3 sections. He talks about that middle section as being plastic. Do you guys remember that? He says you have a thought and it goes through plastic like a plastic mold and then out it comes in your life and form. He talks about plastic. Well, this is the brilliance. So brilliant. In 1962, 2 years after he had passed away, there was the first school of neuroscience that came into being. And neuroplasticity was discovered in 1970. So he wrote his book in 26, and neuroplasticity was discovered in the 70s. Isn't that amazing? And what neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to reorganize itself. It's structural plasticity. It changes its structure. So where science of mind has brought such a gift onto this planet to be able to say we can change our mind and we can change our life, what science now tells us is that we literally change our brain when we change our mind and back it up with our activity. Isn't that awesome? All right. So let's close in prayer. And I just so invite you guys this week to really play with the idea that desire comes from the heavens or comes from the stars into your body temple. I invite you to play with the idea that a desire is the marriage of the head and the heart. And I invite you to play with the idea that desire is one of the most holy activities that we get to experience as human beings, as spiritual beings, as beings here on this planet. So let's put one hand over our heart and one on our first eye here. And I just give thanks that the truth is that God is all there is. There is no God and me or God and you. There is God as me and God as you. That this divine presence of God that is always acting in, through, and as its creation does so in concert and through our own desire. How lovely it is that you and I have the privilege to be lit up with desire while we're on this planet. And so from this moment forward, I claim that this thing called desire is not a passing whimsy, but that it actually is an opportunity for us to stop and to realize the creative force of the universe in operation through us. And so I give thanks for all of this. I give thanks for all of this. I give thanks for all of this. And I give thanks for this life that I lead and the life that you lead and this opportunity for us to come together today in order that more life, more God, more good can be expressed through us. And so it is. Amen.
Today in the children's program, our focus was on self-acceptance, and we read a book about crayons. And the red didn't like the blue, and nobody liked the orange. And I think the green was kind of not happy either. But a little girl bought the box of crayons, and she used them all to color a beautiful picture. And they all realized that when they worked together, that they create beauty in the world. And they liked each other after that. Just like us, we're all different. But together, we make a beautiful picture.